All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 53 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the elementary class. We are returning to the story of the Greco-Persian Wars. And we left off with the Persian king, Dariush, giving one of his servants an unenviable job. What was the job of one of his slaves, which you didn't want to get picked for? Patrick, go ahead.
To keep on reminding him about Persia to plan his revenge, so eventually he would get so angry he would strike him out.
Yeah, but you said one, you inadvertently said to remind him of Persia. What did you really mean?
I mean Athens.
Athens, right? So the message was, remember the Athenians. Okay. And so basically his job was to annoy his boss. When did you ever hear of a job like that, right? Okay. All right. So what are your qualifications, sir? I'm especially annoying. You're hired. Right? So, no, that doesn't usually work, right? But in this case, for this very strange job, you had to be willing to annoy your boss. And so now, why did Dariush, to use the Persian pronunciation, Dariush, why did he want a servant to say, remember the Athenians? Now notice it's very specific. He did not say to his boss every meal, remember the Greeks. Why was it the Athenians that Dariush was to be reminded of, not the Greeks? He didn't have a grudge against Greece. He had a grudge against Athens. So, let me remind you a little bit of the context of what we call the Ionian Revolt. Okay, sharing my screen with you guys again here and taking you to our map of Greece. Zooming in a bit as well. Okay, so we go back here. And why is the event called the Ionian Revolt that starts the Greco-Persian War? Well, this region here, as is labeled on the map, is called Ionia. And this region rebelled against the Persian king and asked Athens for help. They, in fact, had asked others for help first. They asked the Spartans first because they knew the Spartans were tough. And the Spartans decided not to help. And then they went to Athens, and Athens decided to help. But what we learned was that the Athenians had a grudge of their own, which was motivating them to participate. In other words, they didn't just want to help the Ionians revolt. They wanted to go to Sardis because there was somebody there they wanted to get a hold of. Anybody remember? He was a son of Pisistratus. And he has a kind of funny sounding name. Julia, please.
Hippias?
Yeah, Hippias. Okay. not a very glorious name in modern sounds, right? But anyway, so Pisistratus has been the tyrant, and he had two sons who were really tyrannical. Hippias and Hipparchus were the ones that succeeded him. And the Greeks killed Hipparchus, and they exiled Hippias. Or the Greeks, I mean the Athenians specifically. Okay, and so Hippias was in the Persian Empire. They thought he was at Sardis. They wanted to go, and they sacked it. And, well, that got them in trouble because this, of course, brought them to the attention of Dariush, who wanted then his servant to remind him of this terrible thing that they had done, right? Now, here is the strange thing that we were talking about a little bit last time, was that, well, one of the things that led to the Ionian Revolt was that these colonies here in Ionia wanted democracy. They were influenced by Athens, and they wanted democracy. And so that was something that led them to revolt. But it's very interesting, and I asked you the question, well, would the Persian Empire be upset about that? Would the Persian Empire allow democracy or not? And you guys weren't too sure. And my hint to you guys was it didn't matter to them. Because democracy back then did not mean what it means to us in modern times, right? It wasn't a big deal. Now it's a big deal. So you talk about democracy today, and you talk about somebody changing from not having a democracy to having a democracy. Let's say everybody's talking about China as the main example in modern times. China doesn't have a democracy. Imagine if China became a democracy. Right, that would be an anchor fact of history. Just like that, snap your fingers, you got a new anchor fact. Because that would transform China from the kind of government that it has. Okay, but back then, you take a single little Greek city-state and you turn it into a democracy. Nobody really cares. It's not a big deal yet. It's the beginning of the story. So, Persians didn't really care. And actually, we had a sign of that because when they rebelled, and with the Athenians' help, and the Persians came and reconquered them, guess what kind of government they were allowed to have? Ooh, talk about a leading question. Come on, you have to answer the easy ones as well as the hard ones. You know, I like to have a little back and forth. So somehow, either this is such an easy question that you're embarrassed to answer it, because Mr. Powell, why would you ask me such an easy question? Or, which would be a little bit astounding to me, it's a hard question. Which one is it? Easy or hard? Am I the only one here? Okay, Rosetta, help me out.
She couldn't hear your question.
Oh, well, that's a big... Okay, you couldn't hear my... Maybe I was going too fast. Okay, thank you. Opal says, what's the question? Okay, the question was this. What kind of government did the Persians allow the Ionians to have after they were reconquered? Okay, Opal, you think you got it now?
Democracy?
Democracy, yes. That's why I said it was a leading question, right? I was saying, well, would democracy work inside the Persian Empire? And we would think maybe not. But as soon as the Greeks were reconquered in that area, they were allowed to have democracies. So that wasn't the big deal. What was the big deal in modern... Well, I'm sorry, not modern. In Persia. What was the one thing you had to do if you were in the Persian Empire? You could have your own religion. Make one up and have it and do whatever you want there. And you can make up a new kind of government and you could do whatever you want there too. But you gotta do one thing. What's that? Julia?
Attack Greece?
Yeah, well, you gotta do... That's an example of what you gotta do. What's the general thing that you have to do, Julia?
Jump when they say jump.
Yeah, nicely put, right? When the Persian Empire says jump, you jump. Okay, right. So in this case, if they say jump across the Aegean Sea and attack your own homeland, you got to do it. Which, of course, is where the Greeks really started to have this problem. And why the Greco-Persian Wars are so important is that, well, it was going to end up having the Greeks destroy the Greeks before they could ever have the greatest part of their history. They were about to have it, as we are going to see. After the Greco-Persian Wars, the Greeks are going to have the best part of their history. It's the peak of what we call the classical age. It's wonderful. It's really beautiful. It's probably the greatest time in history, except for, in some ways, the modern era. With all of our technology, we have some things that are more wonderful. But back then, I think it's probably the most amazing time to be alive as a human being because of all that was being learned for the first time. If you're a person who likes to learn stuff, you would not have found a better place to be alive than classical Greece. So it was just a wonderful time, and it would have never happened if the Greeks had killed each other. Sadly, that's what they're going to end up doing later on, but at least they're not going to do it now. They're not going to, well, they're going to have to do it with the Persians because they've been conquered. But fortunately, enough of them are going to resist. So let me erase this particular annotation here, and let's get back to the Persians attacking, because now that they have control over this area, they are going to attack. The first attack is going to come the way the Persians know how to do it. Now, what I mean by that is, if we look at the Persian Empire, and I'm a little bit at a loss for the right thing to bring up here, so let me go back, let's see, lower elementary ancient history. And do we have, I might not have put a map of the Persian Empire on there. I'm thinking that I haven't done it yet. So that would be my fault. But let me go ahead and put Persian Empire on there. No. I've made a mistake. And I don't have it quickly available. All right, so this point I'm going to have to make without the benefit of a map. So the Persian Empire was a land empire. It'd be way more exciting if I could show you on a map. But anyway, the Persian Empire was a land empire. Now, why does that matter? Well, Persia's over here, and Greece is where? Yes, Mr. Powell, that's another easy one. Greece is over here. Okay, why does it matter that Persia is a land empire, and why am I pointing out such a simple geographical fact? Land empire, other place to conquer. Land empire, other place to conquer. What's the big deal? Rosetta?
You actually have to succeed in crossing the sea.
There's a sea right there. Exactly. I'll give you another example of a land empire. The Mongol Empire, or the Huns, you know, back in ancient times. They only went on land. If there was a sea between you and them, you were safe. They were never going to get to you. So it's a different, it's a whole different game going on the water. And so the Persians were not expert at that. And so the first goal of theirs was to get to Greece without having to go on water. Can you do it? Is it possible to go from here on the right over to the left without going on water? Hopeful?
Well, you have to go on a little bit of water, but it doesn't have to be very much.
Yeah, if we're just looking at this size of a map here, sorry if I cut you off, Opal. If you're just looking at this map, there's one spot that you can cross that is the closest spot in terms of the distance between this side we would call on the right, we call that Asia. This is Asia Minor, right? And over here is Europe. So this is called right here, the gap between Asia and Europe is called the Hellespont. Helles actually is kind of like Greece. Hellas is the Greek word for Greece. And pont, anybody know what a pont is? En français, it's a pont. I thought Rosetta might know that one. It is a bridge. So the Hellespont is a bridge to Greece. All right. So the shortest gap between Asia and Europe here is the Hellespont. So Darius sent his son-in-law to do this first effort. And so, you know, Darius likes to give people tough jobs. So he sent his son-in-law to do this particular effort and sent his army across here. And sent a fleet along with it. And since they didn't know the Aegean Sea well, they decided to have the fleet go on this kind of path here, where, and this is just like when the Age of Discovery started. If you might know about in the Age of Discovery, when the Portuguese navigators before Columbus went to try to get to Asia, they tried to go to Asia by basically sailing along the side of Africa. Because they didn't want to go in the open ocean. Because they, if you don't know the ocean, it's pretty scary to go in the middle and not be able to see any land anywhere. Where are you and how do you get where you're going to go? Right? So you have to be really knowledgeable and brave to go in the middle of the ocean. So the Persians kind of were in the same situation. They decided to take their army across and the fleet to join it alongside and go along the water. But they didn't, because they didn't know this sea. And then you get to this very strange piece of land here. Look at this piece of land. It is one of the weirdest you'll ever see. Looks like a fork, right? Like a trident. Mm-hmm. It's a peninsula that's in the shape of a trident. It's called, it has a very, very hard to pronounce, I have to say. Chalkidiki. That is how I've heard it pronounced. Okay? You would think it would be Chalcedice, but apparently it's Chalkidiki. Yes, Patrick.
Chalkidiki doesn't seem that hard to pronounce.
Doesn't seem, oh, okay, fine, fine. I found it hard. Okay, so anyway, the fleet came around here, and you can see there's a big mountain here, and this turns out to be a very treacherous stretch of ocean, and the kind of ships that they had were not very well designed for the seas. They had what are called triremes. Now, that's not the one that I wanted. There they are. These are modern reproductions of ancient triremes. And so these are the Greek designs, but the Persians ones were not all that different. And they had three rows of rowers, one down here. You can see the oars sticking out, and then one here in the middle, and then one here at the top. These guys have the best job because they have the window seats, but they have to work hard nonetheless. Everybody rows together. You have the wind power and you have the sailing power of all of the people on board, but they're not very, you would never want to take a boat like this on the open ocean. Like Columbus could never have gotten to America on a boat like this. They're not designed for sailing so much on choppy seas. They're designed for pretty much one thing. Can you guess what it is from this interesting shape at the front of the boat? This is like an eye. Right? And you see what this is here? Why is the front of the boat pointy like that?
Is it for hunting fish?
No. No, I mean, that would be kind of what the idea of a bird or some kind of creature, right, would be a symbol of. But the boat is pointy for one very specific reason. Wyatt, Henry? For battle, but what do you do with the pointy boat, Wyatt, in battle?
Well, pretty much the idea is that you get going really fast. And the fact is that in battle, the triremes would actually take down their sails.
Okay, that's true, because they only need to go...
But then everybody starts rowing really fast, and they can ram a ship.
Exactly.
Making a very big hole in the side of it. And then pretty much sinking the ship.
Exactly. Perfect, right? So the point of this pointy metal part on the ship is to make a huge hole in the enemy's ship, and then their ship sinks. So the design of the trireme is basically to go as fast as you can in one direction. It's not really made for sailing around the world or something like that. Yes, Patrick?
Yeah, the pointy thing just crashes into your ship at full speed,
yes.
Makes a ton of water come in and slowly sink the ship.
Exactly. Okay, so you get it, but it's not a good design for sailing. So when they made their way here, this map is a different colored map, but same one. It shows the course of the fleet here, and then it says, okay, when they got here, big storm, most of the fleet was sunk because they weren't good at that sort of thing, and they had to give up. So ... they went back, and whoever survived went back, but most of them were sunk right here. So it was quite not a very good beginning for the Persians. They wanted to invade Greece, and they didn't even get to fight the Greeks, basically. There were some primitive tribes up here that they had their troubles with. And then the weather stopped them, which is not particularly fun. So then Darius decides, okay, it's time for me to get down to business and do this myself. And so the second expedition is here with this line. This map is a little bit busier than I would like, but I'm just going to follow this line here in dark brown. And you can see that by the time they get to Ionia here, then what did they do? All right, we're not going to mess around anymore. We're going to go straight across. And so they decided, and who are we going to attack? Well, we got a target here. We have Athens that we want to deal with. And so, of course, to get across, it sure would be nice if you know a lot about the Greek geography. Is there anybody that can help you with that? Is there anybody Greek who might like to make trouble for Athens? Maybe a former Tyrannos. That you tried to kill at Sardis, and he's got a grudge too, Julia?
Hippias.
Julia remembers Hippias.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there you go. So Hippias came along with Dariush's expedition to attack Athens, and then they arrive here with their fleet, and it's at a place. Well, here it is. Here it is, actually. Apologize. So it's called a location called Marathon. And now I'm going to switch over to a map to describe what happened at the Battle of Marathon. Before that, I'll tell you one brief story about the Battle of Marathon. We know this word marathon in modern times, don't we? What does the word marathon mean today? Opal?
It's, I think, 28 miles?
On that order, I think it's 26, I think. And it's 28 mile, 26 mile what?
Race.
Okay, what kind of race?
A long one?
I mean on foot, as opposed to on a bicycle or in a car or something like that, right? So it's a foot race. Yeah, and 28 miles, 26 miles is really long, so they don't sprint the whole way. Right. Well, actually, the Athenians sent a runner from Athens to Sparta in order to get them to beg them for help. And Athens to Sparta by land is actually 140 miles. And there's a famous story about a runner named Pheidippides. And Pheidippides ran 140 miles in 36 hours. Wow. So that's, if you want to know what a real marathon is, that's what it is. And I think then he ran back. Also, I think he also ran there and then ran back. The answer was not a very happy one. The Spartans were pretty superstitious. There was a full moon and a religious festival coming, and they refused to go to war. So, you know, when you have these religious festivals, they can be very important to people, of course, and you wouldn't necessarily do something at that time of year. So, the Spartans refused to help. The Athenians were on their own, and they were way outnumbered. So, what was going to happen? Well, here is one of the only times that you're going to get an example of military history in History at Our House, because it's a specialized science. Military history studies the way that battles are fought in order to try to learn battles and wars, and in order to try to learn the principles that can help make armies succeed. And so this is an example of a map that military academies use. I think it's actually a map that's used by West Point, which is the American Army's Military Academy. And so the map here shows that the Persians in red arrived at the waterfront, and there were a lot of them. Okay? And they were organized in these units here in red. So these rectangles represent just thousands of soldiers all packed together in units. Okay? And then the blue lines represent rectangles full of Greek soldiers. And they start off in these positions with the dotted lines. And then as the battle goes, the arrows show the movement that they make. Okay? So what the Greeks did was they moved down. They have, first of all, they're higher up, right? These are like hills. White is next to the water, low, and yellow, and then gray is higher up, or beige is higher up. So the Greek army moved down, as you can see by this arrow. And then the Persian army did what?
Move up.
Moved up. Okay, good. Okay, moved up to meet them. But then what did the Greek army do? Rosetta?
They moved back to their original course.
They moved back, okay? And this maneuver is designed to incite or to encourage the opposing army to come meet you, right? The two armies are facing each other, and you represent that this is your army. So then they have a bigger army, and they're thinking, okay, let's go crush that army. And you can see here that these guys on the side also come into the center in order to attack this smaller force. Now, if they are drawn into the center like this, and then the blue army retreats, what's the second thing that the blue army did? Which is why this maneuver is called a double envelopment. What's the other thing the Blue Army did? As the first force retreats, drawing the enemy in tighter towards them, what happens over here? The other part of the Greek army does what? Rosetta?
I guess they are enclosing in them.
Enclosing.
They're being closer.
Exactly. They are attacking the side of the army. And guess what? Everybody knows that the side of the army is weaker than the center. Who do you put in the center and the ones that are going to fight the battle? You put the ones that are tough, right? You put the ones that you expect to defeat the enemy, and you leave the other guys over to the side. This is called the flank. And if you expose your flank, you are in trouble. Military generals and historians know this. It's a weakness. So what the double envelopment maneuver does is it forces, or it doesn't force, but it tricks the enemy into exposing their flank on both sides. So what you're doing here is you're taking your strongest soldiers and you trick the other guy. You make him think that they're in the center, but they're actually on the sides. So you end up getting your best soldiers against the weakest soldier of the enemy, and they start slaughtering them on the sides. Now, when that happens, the enemy all of a sudden is facing another enemy. Another enemy that is around them on all three sides. And that's scary, right? You might be a strong army. You might have lots of soldiers. But meanwhile, you're fighting at the front, and then you're noticing that on the sides, all your comrades are dying, and the other army is coming around you on all sides, it seems like. And guess what? There's only one place where you feel safe. So in the words of a famous knight of the round table, run away, run away. Right? There's only one place to go. Back to your ships, retreat and run away. And so this maneuver allowed, the Greeks were way outnumbered, but their generals were very accomplished, and this allowed them to defeat the Persians at the Battle of Marathon. So this was, well, it was technically it was the second attempt of the Persians to punish the Greeks. The first one failed because of weather. The second one failed because The Athenians defeated them at the Battle of Marathon. So this is not going too well for this great Persian Empire. But you know, you can sense here that this is just one battle, right? This is a fleet of ships that came across and they lost because, well, the Greek generals were really brilliant. And so what's going to happen next? Well, the Persian emperor, the Persian king, so to speak, was not discouraged by this. He was just angry, right? And so the planning began for the next round of attacks, and it was going to become the largest army that in the history of the world up to that point was going to be formed by the Persian Empire, in order to attack Greece. But it wasn't going to be Darius, because Darius died and the Persians had to withdraw for a while. There was a rebellion against the Persian Empire in Egypt. So the Persians had to kind of sort things out for a bit, and Darius died. And then there was a little while in between, and then pretty soon there was a new Persian king called Xerxes. And he is the one that we are going to talk about tomorrow. So we'll get to Xerxes. He's kind of got a cool name. Here it is. Xerxes is going to be the Persian king who's really going to now form up this gigantic army. We'll talk more about him tomorrow because we ran out of time. I expected to be able to talk a little bit more about him today and his gigantic army. But we'll talk about that Xerxes' huge army and his great confidence that he was going to crush Greece with such a gigantic army. And I guess what I'm going to do is I'm going to leave you with a little bit of a teaser question that you might want to just, who knows, have a discussion about at the dinner table tonight with the military historians of your family. And the discussion is as follows. Is more better? Is more better? Is that the same thing? Or is bigger better? And I'll give you a more specific question, which means, is a bigger army necessarily better? And it would seem to be such an obvious answer that you know very well why I am asking it. So if you don't, well, I guess I'll have to explain tomorrow. But go ahead and have the discussion anyway. Maybe I'll ask you a leading question. In what ways might a bigger army not be better? So if you want to see if you can tease your brain to giving you some answers to that question, when would a bigger army not be better? That might be an interesting way to prepare for the next chapter here of the Greco-Persian War. Okay, guys, that'll do it for today. Thanks, everybody. We'll pick things up tomorrow. Bye for now.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye-bye.
Bye.